Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It hasn't been a fantastic recovery since the Great Recession, but recovery sure beats the alternative. And right now, some people are worried about the alternative. Again, slowdown. Maybe even a slide toward recession. China's got issues. They travel. The U.S. has issues, too, but also real strengths. This hour On Point, the real state of the U.S. economy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see? Good times rolling? Rolling away? Never came back? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Alan Sinai, chief global economist and strategist at Decision Economics. Alan Sinai, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
And from Paris, France, no less, Catherine Mann is with us, chief economist at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. She spent 13 years on the Federal Reserve Board from 84 to 97, so she knows that terrain. Catherine Mann, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Give us the view from across the pond in Paris. We've got people back here in the States. A Washington Post headline, economists start to warn about the risk of a new U.S. recession. Wall Street Journal headline, U.S. companies warn of slowing economy. What do you see from your perch, Catherine?
Well, I think that what we're seeing over here is that in comparison to the United States, you know, the rest of the world is not as in good a shape, but the U.S. is in pretty good shape. So I think the real question is to what extent the U.S. can play the locomotive role that it has in all previous recovery periods. It's much more challenging this time around. The U.S. economy is not as big relative to everybody else as it used to be. But, you know, from the U.S. standpoint, Not everything is great, for sure, but there are other parts of the world that are in much bigger trouble. I do think that that is why when we look at the Wall Street Journal headline, mm-hmm. for example, multinationals are mostly, you know, they're exposed. 50% of their profits and revenues come from abroad. And so they're looking at global growth prospects, and they're not seeing the kind of improvement that they were hoping for. Plus, they've got the strong exchange value of the dollar that tends to translate their profits earned abroad into fewer dollars, so they get a double whammy. And so from a multinational's perspective, which is more global than just looking at the U.S. economy alone, mm-hmm. That's why we're getting, I think, a different picture from the U.S., from the multinationals versus from somebody, for example, who's in the Russell 2000, the small caps.
Help us understand the significance, the reach of China's cooling. I mean, I'm reading here, New York Times, mm-hmm. South America, Africa, an economic freeze because China just doesn't have that giant demand anymore for all those commodities and all those raw materials to go into building out new infrastructure and cities and all the rest. And they're talking about miners in Minnesota, oil field workers in Texas, North Dakota, farmers in Iowa, heavy equipment makers in the United States, also feeling the pinch from China's cooling. How big a factor is that, and has the U.S. been somehow holding that at bay and it's now starting to bite?
So I think there are two separate things that I would talk about there. One focused on oil in particular, and then the other one on other commodities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just an important distinction because to some extent the global decline in oil prices is partly a success of our own making, so to speak, mm-hmm. with the effective shale gas and production in the United States really altering the sort of the production, global production picture. those shale producers, of course, having a problem right now, but are very nimble and are acting as a sort of a constraint on the potential increases in oil prices. So I would put that one to the side. It certainly has an impact on the U.S. economy. Oil is a big factor, and we definitely see it in some places. But, you know, on balance, the U.S. is still a user, a net user of oil, as are many other economies around the world. And so on balance, we take the whole picture. And on the oil side, it's a gain for the global economy, maybe of a half a percentage point. On the commodity side, more generally, I mean, I think this is where the very big delta in terms of China's demand for a whole range of commodities, there really has been a tremendous shift in their demand for you know, cement mm-hmm. and copper and, you know, everything else. Mm-hmm. And that's part of their rebalancing strategy. That's part of their rebalancing strategy. So in some sense, we should have seen it coming.
To bump up domestic demand
sure,
as a factor in their own economy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Focus on consumption rather mm-hmm. than investment. The idea was that investment was supposed to cool down. Consumption was supposed to be bolstered up. Consumption is, generally speaking, not as commodity intensive. And so, you know, overall decline in commodity prices, the snap down in them has been really dramatic. But, you know, there are two effects here. One is there are countries around the world that are very dependent on commodities. So we're talking Brazil, Russia, Canada, and mm-hmm, Australia. Mm-hmm. And so those immediately have a negative turn to their economies because they're not exporting as much or not as much value in any case. And so that has a knock-on effect to demand more generally for a broad range of products.
Those countries then not going to be in the market for as many American exports when
sure,
they're not selling
not
their
American
commodities.
American exports and not Chinese exports either, uh-huh. because a lot of those, you know, Brazil and China have a very, very strong trade relationship, not just in commodities, but more generally in finished products. So when Brazil doesn't do as well, and this is also true of other Asian economies, the overall demand for Chinese exports goes down and Chinese imports go down. So the overall rate of growth of trade for emerging markets has actually gone negative, something that is very, very rare and actually a very significant concern. And I think you're seeing that issue, trade declining, as being a canary in the coal mine. The only time we see trade declining and is really in recession mm-hmm, periods. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of people are picking up on the data that we've seen in 2015 and said, wow, this only happens in a global recession.
Catherine Mann, standby in Paris. Alan Sinai with me right here. I'm quoting here the chief financial officer for Fastenal, American company that make nuts and bolts, basic as you can get, says the industrial environment's in a recession. I don't care what anybody says. Of course, that's just one part of the economic pie. What do you see, Alan?
Well, I think that's right. The industrial side of the U.S. economy on industrial production data and other data that relate to that part of the economy does look like it's in very close to recession, if not in recession.
That's
but that is a very small
factory land, industrial production.
Yeah, it's a very small part of the economy. It's smaller now than ever before. We used to define a recession on three declining months of industrial production. We don't now because the U.S. economy is a services economy. The consumer in aggregate is almost 70% of the U.S. economy. So how the U.S. economy goes will depend on how the consumer goes.
Okay.
And that particular slot or slice of life and a lot of what Catherine talked about, U.S. exports are 12 or 13% of GDP. By itself, it can slow the economy some, but it can't take it down.
So how's the consumer doing in that case
great.
Against all this?
Consumer is doing great. The last four quarters, inflation-adjusted aggregate consumption is up over 3% on a year-over-year basis. That's now four quarters. It's a little-known fact. Consumer spending is strong. The fundamentals around the American consumer are terrific. As long as those fundamentals, jobs and income, attitude, sentiment, low interest rates, banks lending money, the household balance sheet, which on our measures is in the best shape ever, believe it or not.
Meaning debt down, in other words.
Oh, debt is down as a percent of income. Debt is down as a percent of assets. Interest charges as a percent of income are way down. The various measures of household financial conditions are really glowing. As long as those fundamentals stay good, particularly jobs and income, the consumer will spend – more than the consumer has been spending in past years, and the U.S. economy should do better.
But
in
we see
aggregate.
Job growth slowing. We see income, we're told all the time, essentially stagnant for a long time.
So that's not correct.
Okay, help us out here.
Real income is up 4.5% over the last year. Inflation adjusted. Remember, oil prices, energy costs are way down.
True.
U.S. inflation year over year on the Federal Reserve's preferred measure is up 0.3% year over year. We did not give our retired people, like me, any extra money because the CPI hardly went up. And so the cost of living is not there. Inflation is almost non-existent in the United States, so that real income, inflation adjusted, is rising nicely and supporting the kind of spending that we are seeing, which is strong.
Strong in what? Leisure spending, restaurants?
Well, leisure, hospitality, healthcare is very strong. Auto sales are now at a new high. Home sales are very new high. It's firing almost everywhere on consumer spending. And that's the U.S. economy. I worry about recession if I start to worry about any of those fundamentals.
Kevin Mann, yeah. How about that pressure from abroad, China's issues and all the rest? You go through Brazil and Australia and South Africa, and pretty soon you got a lot of countries on that strand. We've seen developing countries and the trade issues you describe. Is the U.S. now invulnerable to that? Can this consumer strength go on carrying the U.S. economy regardless of what happens abroad?
Well, as I said, the U.S. economy has had a role to play in bringing the global economy out of recession and into high growth periods more than one time in my life as an economist. So, the question is, can it do it again? I think, one of the interesting observations that I would like to add to what Alan said about the strength of the U.S. consumer, and by and large, I agree with what he has to say, looking at the top line numbers, is that the certain areas that are relatively weaker than would normally be the case at this kind of given the pace of consumption growth that we observe, what's weaker is imported stuff. Clothing and footwear, furnishings. That's the stuff that usually comes from abroad. That's usually the transmission mechanism for the U.S. to be a locomotive. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it happening this time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real state of the U.S. economy and whether it is slowing down right now. Alan Sinai is with us from Decision Economics. Catherine Mann joins us from Paris, France, chief economist, head of the economics department at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Stephen Roach joins us in just a moment. You can join us as well. What do you see? Is the post-recession swell in the U.S. economy flattening out, or do things still look pretty good to you? And what are the indicators you look to? What do you see in your world where you hit the economy? Of course, a lot of economic talk in the presidential debates. We saw it with the Democrats. When they stepped up to the debate podium, the Republicans slated to talk about economics this week in their latest debate. Let's hear from our listeners. Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Justin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess the reason I called is I guess I don't necessarily agree with the numbers that your panel had stated before. I'm a working class younger generation.
Okay.
And I guess I see that, we still do not see the rise in income. And I really do believe that, the people that are striving are really actually the CEOs.
You don't feel like it's coming to you. Of course, we've heard a lot about that. And we've got, Justin, I appreciate your call. Alan Sinai, we've got a lot of that online as well. Megan says, ha, some of us never recovered from the previous recession. Using the term another is just laughable. And here's another listener saying, isn't this discussion moot when the real unemployment rate, he's saying here, is close to 24% when you bring in all those who've checked out of the job market? You hear Justin, he's not feeling it. It feels like it's somewhere else. What do you say?
Well, they're all right. They're correct. This has been very much recovery for upper income and particular segments of our society. And the nature of the stimulus, the monetary policy stimulus, which has helped housing prices go up, helped the stock market go up, mm-hmm. kept interest rates down. That does hurt some people, interest rates down. Means that those callers and where they are and where they sit in our economy are not feeling good in this upturn.
Well, what kind of conversation is it where the numbers can all look good and we can say we don't have a problem and yet, you know,
the numbers
a huge
don't,
chunk of the people
yeah,
aren't
the
included.
Numbers do
That's
not
kind
speak,
of a hocus-pocus conversation.
They don't speak to the inequality that exists in our economy.
Is there so much at the top that the economy can do well in terms of traditional measures
no,
and still
not,
hide
not,
a whole not, swamp of
not
despair?
Not ultimately. I suspect the people called in, they have jobs, they're earning money, they're feeling the squeeze, they have maybe college education to pay for that's very expensive, the burden of house payments, and the upward mobility in jobs isn't yet for them what they may have seen before, nor is the ability to earn more money in their job the way it used to be.
Catherine Mann, you're there at the OECD now, mm-hmm. sitting in Paris, looking at Europe and other industrialized countries. What about the distribution of the benefits of economy for better and for ill in the U.S. compared to the others you're now riding herd on?
So in comparison to the United States, the economies in Europe generally have a more equitable distribution of income. They have a stronger social safety net and redistribution role for the government. That's by and large true. And, for example, a number of them have very high minimum wages. Where there is some erosion, though, within Europe, and I think this is an important element of what it means to have inequity in a society is that the unemployment rates within Europe, by and large, except for Germany, mm-hmm. which has a very low unemployment rate, other than that, the unemployment rates are very high, much higher than they are in the United States. So there's an inequality in opportunity to engage with the labor force and engage with work here that is very pernicious, especially for young people where unemployment rates are 25% and above. One of the things that I think I would put as on the table as a real problem for getting us out of the inequality part of this recession stagnant situation is the striking lack of investment in the real economy that is pervasive around the world except for in China.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that investment in the real economy? What
does
that mean to you?
Well, what I mean is, this is factories buying new machines or buying more computers. This is new software being produced. You know, Google's doing a lot, but a lot of mm-hmm. other people aren't. This investment, it represents the capacity of an economy to bring more people into work because, by and large, capital and labor are complements. They work together. You know, of course, we know robots substitute sometimes
yep, yep.
for some workers. But if you look at them over everybody, capital and labor are complements. And so if you got more capital in there, meaning more investment in the real economy, then that would create more jobs. More jobs would create the foundation for stronger wage growth, and that would support more broad-based consumption.
Why aren't companies making those investments? They've been so flush with cash, you would think that this is the time to do it. Why not?
You know, this is a problem for what we've been struggling with, trying to understand this. It was the focus of the OECD's last Economic Outlook presentation and report last June. And I think there are a couple of elements. The one element that I would like to focus on is that there is a collective action problem with investment. A company says, I don't just invest in my own economy. I care about what's going on in my neighborhood, countries around me. And we've been in a world where, one country sort of does better, but kind of everybody else is not doing so good. So the investors sort of say, I can do okay with the plant and equipment that I have. I don't really need to buy anything new. I can do okay with running my workers a little bit on overtime. I don't really have to, hire any new ones. And then last year it was kind of the the emerging markets were doing better and the advanced economies were not doing as well. And so investment sort of says, global economy isn't doing enough for me to really get out there and invest. This year, it's kind of the other way around. The advanced are doing a little bit better, but mm-hmm. the emerging markets are doing much worse because of the China factor and the commodity factor and the global value chain factor. So we have not yet gotten into this thing where we've got both horses, you know, the advanced and the emergency and the emerging markets both working forward to like get the cart going. And, we focus a lot at the OECD on the importance of a range of pro-competitive policies in the business environment and financial environment and the labor market.
Yeah.
In conjunction with social safety nets, so we're not, throwing people out of the boat, but that these are important ingredients in creating an environment that will promote investment along with fiscal and monetary policy being necessary complements for any kind of structural policy approaches.
Kevin Mann, stand by there in Paris. I want to get one caller here, and we'll bring Stephen Roach in. Patty in Edmond, Oklahoma. Patty, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you see there in Edmond, Patty?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We have what I call a diverse family.
Okay.
My husband's a geologist. Luckily, he has not been laid off. We have a daughter who's a rocket scientist. Granted, she's working in Huntsville. And we have a son who's a CPA.
Okay.
The daughter who's the rocket scientist gets paid horribly for her degrees.
Is she working on NASA stuff or what kind of rocketry?
She is working NASA in conjunction with Boeing. The next rocket that goes up in 2020, mm-hmm. that is what she is working on as an engineer.
But at least she's got work. Geologist husband with the oil patch in trouble, is he in trouble?
No, he is fine. Luckily, he is very, very fine. But you see, all these people get laid off, of course, being the oil economy.
Mm-hmm.
Our son, the CPA, he is having to spend as much time as he does in auditing both the front side and what he calls the back side, which is ERISA audits. Their business is going down because companies are just not wanting to be audited because they aren't making any money because of the oil situation.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got Chesapeake Energy who puts on a beautiful light show in a section on their campus area. And normally by now their lights would be going up. They aren't. But in the same instance, we have Trader Joe's coming into town. We have all these stores opening. But yet when I'm a stay-at-home mom, I go and do my food shopping and that, and no one's in the stores.
Net, Patty, are you optimistic? Do things look promising to you? Or is the shadow over oil and gas production now so big in Oklahoma that you can't see it that way?
Oh, no. We have been in this industry for 30-something plus years. So we have seen the roller coaster come up. We see the roller coaster go down. Each time that there is a roller coaster going up, the plateaus stay high longer. But when it comes down, it stays down longer.
An oil patch pain right now. Patty, I appreciate your call I very much. I want to get Stephen Roach in here, if I may, senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs, senior lecturer at the School of Management there, former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, former chief economist at Morgan Stanley. Stephen Roach, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. How would you describe the recovery that we've been living in? And then help us look over the lip of the future here. But the recovery that we are in, I guess, still.
I think Justin nailed it. I always like to listen to the people who are really on the firing line. This is a lousy recovery. The economy has grown by fits and starts since the crisis. But the average growth rate over the bulk of this recovery has been a little bit more than basically 2%, and normally a recovery 6 years after a business cycle trough is about 2 percentage points faster than that. The unemployment rate is much higher than the published data indicate. If it was as close to full employment as the Fed wants you to believe, we'd be seeing some wage inflation by now, but we're certainly not seeing that. And with all due respect to my old friend Alan Sinai, I think the consumer is much weaker than the trend over the last four quarters would indicate. We had a growth rate of consumer demand, inflation adjusted, that's averaged about 1.5% for the past 7.5 years, which is the weakest period of consumption on record post-World War II, largely because consumers were damaged almost fatally by a horrific crisis, and they're still trying to dig out from under it in terms of paying down outsized debt loads and rebuilding savings balances. And with consumer demand close to 70% of the economy, the other 30% is just not strong enough to really make a difference. So whether you look at it from the standpoint of the labor market, our productivity performance, which has been terrible, our rural GDP growth, or consumer demand, there's nothing to write home about the subpar, anemic, and fragile U.S. economic recovery.
I'll get Alan Sina to respond to that, but speak to the fragility then. How do you see the vulnerability of this economy looking forward? We see the issues abroad. The U.S. has looked fairly good relatively. At least that's the conventional wisdom. How do you see the U.S. economy positioned now?
Well, like as Kathy said at the outset, we do look good relatively, but that's not the consolation that we need relative to our own performance historically.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second half of this year, the growth rate looks like it's going to slow on a GDP basis to about 1.5%. And that is very near the stall speed of the U.S. economy. So if anything bad were to happen when we're barely growing at 1.5%, we lack the cushion that could enable us to avoid slipping into an unexpected recession. So I think growing vulnerability as we move into this weaker period in the second half of 2015.
Alan Sinai, near the stall speed at 1.5% growth. And let's bore in on this consumer health because, you laid out some figures and put them in a positive light. Stephen Roach looks at them and says, nah, not good enough. Callers say, yeah, help me.
Look, with all due respect to my old friend Stephen Roach.
There's a lot of respect going on here.
We may not be friends after this. Stephen is citing the average growth rate over the last 7 years,
yes.
And frankly, that's ridiculous.
Why?
Because it's history. So what counts is where we are now and where we're going to go. And where we are now, I wouldn't trivialize over 3% year over year for 4 quarters for aggregate consumption spending, inflation adjusted. That's 4 quarters year over year of 3% plus, which is a different path of growth than we've had before. Over the past 7 years, yeah, the growth rate's lousy. That includes just coming
all
out
that
of that
slow
downturn.
Rise and, out of
yeah,
this.
Yeah, sure. But yeah. I think that is just totally misleading to cite statistics like that and claim that the consumer is weak because of that.
If consumers were still deeply in debt
we grew 3.5 million jobs last year. That generated a whole bunch of income. Inflation is way down, so real income is rising. Inflation is not rising with a low unemployment rate or even the more broadly measured called U6 unemployment rate.
Okay.
But even that is 10% now, and it was about 14-15% before. So the motion is positive. The motion is positive. We need to get help from overseas. The world economy now is much more important to the U.S. than it used to be, and that makes the U.S. less important to the world. So I don't want to overemphasize how the consumer is going to lead the whole world out of it. Japan needs to grow faster, and they are trying very aggressive monetary easing to do that.
Have for a long time.
China, it's showing up in their asset prices, but not yet in their economy.
Okay.
That's the way QE works.
Yeah.
China has cut rates 6 times, and they've cut reserve requirements 4 times. They're trying to step up the pace, and so is the Eurozone using zero interest rates. Eventually, those economies should lift up. And they, in turn, will help the U.S. The U.S. will help some. We can't lead the charge the way it used to be.
So come on, players abroad. Stephen Roach, 4 quarters, 3% plus year-over-year growth. And Alan Sinai says that's the current situation, and that's pretty good.
Well, look, you could slice and dice it any way you want.
Yeah.
Alan's sense of what's relevant is 4 quarters. My sense of what's relevant is a longer period of time. I don't think it's a coincidence that we were in probably the longest period of subpar consumption growth on history. And while the last 4 quarters is better than the preceding 25 quarters, the bottom line is that consumers are growing on an underlying trend basis far, far weaker than Alan would lead you to believe. And that's what explains the weak hiring, the weak investment. With consumer and market demand on a subdued growth trajectory, what company is going to add to capacity? What company is going to commit to long-term hiring in a shaky demand environment? And so I think you're right to focus, Tom, on the consumer debate, and we're at the opposite ends of the spectrum. And you know, I pity your viewers listening to this, and you know, let's hear more from people like Justin who are really out there dealing with real-time issues rather than egghead economists like us.
Oh, I think we're lucky to have everybody at the table, listeners and all of you included. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the real state of the U.S. economy and whether it's slowing down right now. Catherine Mann is with us. She's chief economist at the OECD, joins us today from Paris. Stephen Roach is here, former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, chief economist at Morgan Stanley, with us from New Haven, Connecticut today. Alan Sinai, chief global economist, strategist at Decision Economics, is with me in the studio, and you can join us as well. What do you see out there? What do you see coming? Lots of talk about the economy in the presidential roller derby right now, and we'll look more at that as well. Michael in Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. First off, I have to say, although I've been in business from Cambridge to Hong Kong and back again, and went to Harvard Business School, I don't know enough to call anybody ridiculous. And I remember what my dad used to say, strong language means a weak case. Now, I agree with that Morgan Stanley absolutely right on fellow, because if the economy is driven 70% by consumer spending, the only thing that can drive the economy is to put money in the hands of the people who are called demand. The reason why wages are so low, and we have excess capacity almost every place you look. Now, 70% drives us, but 95% of the growth since the Great Recession began has gone to the top 5 to 1%. They cannot create very much demand. The money has, when people say, why aren't my wages, where have they gone? They have gone directly to the top 5 to 1%. It's no longer the economy, stupid. What the sampler on the wall should read is, it's demand, stupid.
Michael, I appreciate your call. How about it, Alan? The distribution, is there a limit to consumer health, the health of that 70% of the economy, because you've got distribution problems that just you can't buy that many yachts to push it up?
No, there really is a limit. We're not growing as fast as we used to on consumption. We've just edged up into that year-over-year path that I said.
Is that a distribution problem?
Because
no matter how much money you get, the top
1%. Very much a distribution problem, and this has come through in several calls from the callers. And for me, it's very straightforward. In this country, companies maximize shareholder value. It's a mantra. If you maximize shareholder value and run a company, you do your job. If it is maximizing shareholder value, it means maximize the stock price. It means you don't want to hire expensive people. You don't want to raise wages. You want to keep expenses down. It also means that if there's a cheap source of technology, the new technology, which is growing like Topsy, you're going to replace workers with that technology. And that's why we don't have the traditional capital spending that Catherine has talked about all over the world.
Why not? Because the new technology is not out there?
I'm a CEO. Somebody comes to me and says, I can put your IT department, this is apocryphal, out on the cloud, save you tons of money. It's a no-brainer. If I'm a CEO and I'm maximizing shareholder value, maximizing the stock price, I'm going to do that. I'm going to let people go.
But I'm investing in that cloud computing or whatever's going to take
care of it. And that stuff is growing like mad.
So why isn't that – doesn't that add up to more capital spending?
It is not labor – a certain kind of capital spending, equipment spending, which is now the large part of investment, is equipment, and a large part of that is software and intellectual property. That's growing like mad. That's very strong. The labor content per unit of output in that part of our economy is very low.
Catherine Mann, this begins to dovetail back into the presidential debates. Do we need stronger consumer demand spread across more of the population to really be that global engine that you'd like to see?
Well, I agree. I mean, our consumer demand is not nearly as equally distributed as it was in previous recoveries. We're saying the same thing, and we're agreeing with that. I think one of the interesting nuances on the extent to which the U.S. economy has been a locomotive for the global economy in the past has been exactly through consumers buying imported goods and also business investment buying technology and goods from abroad. Neither one of those are happening this time around. So as anemic as this recovery might seem in the U.S., the transmission mechanism of relatively better U.S. compared to everybody else, that's not happening. That's not being transmitted. So not only is the locomotive in the U.S. smaller than it used to be, it is also moving less quickly, so to speak, in terms of transmitting what we are doing to the rest of the world.
But is that fundamentally a political problem in a way, because we've got a distribution problem in this country?
The
if distribution were more even, would we have stronger growth and, you know, everybody's helped out?
No, I think that the distribution issue is entirely about political decisions. I mean, look at, for example, the fight against about a minimum wage in the United States. At the federal level, it's going nowhere. And yet, when individuals within states took it to the ballot box, in other words, it was really close to, if I give a higher minimum wage to people around me, it really is going to come out of my pocket because it's at the state level. When people were given that choice at the ballot box, they voted for it. So they really were voting for distributional fairness when they went to the ballot box.
Let it get to Washington and watch it go down.
Yeah, right. It just
At least so far.
There's no question that that tax and transfer systems are political decisions. They don't happen by themselves. It's a political decision, and it should be a serious part of the political debate.
I think it is this year. White River Junction, Vermont. Philip is calling. Hi, Philip. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay, what do you see?
What I see is I see manufacturing is the base of any true economy, and I cut wood for a living. We ship logs to China.
Okay.
China's economy has slowed. Why aren't we manufacturing at home? We need jobs. The economists are saying 70% of the economy is
consumer-driven, yeah.
You know, you're going into stores. That lower wages for the employees who are at the stores selling the things, not enough money in your pocket at the end of the week to go buy those things that you need, which translates to not enough money to put into savings, which translates not enough money to do everything we all need.
Philip, you're a logger. How old are you? When's the last time you had a raise?
I'm 39 years old. I'll be 40 in January. The last time I had a raise for my logging work was 5 years ago.
That is a long time. Stephen Roach, we hear that kind of story today, and talk about ahistorical. I mean, 5 years without a raise, that sounds un-American, Stephen.
Well, Tom, it's a tough world that, you know, Philip and Justin are alluding to here. I just note, you know, as I'm sitting here talking to you, that we get a report from the Conference Board in New York. The consumer confidence fell very sharply to a five-month low in the month of October. The idea that consumers are a beacon of light in the world's greatest economy, I think, is a dim one at best. And I think, you know, the crux of the problem is that, you know, we had politicians and policymakers and regulators all that led us to a very euphoric state on the brink of this crisis in 08 and 09. And unfortunately, we're paying a steep price as we continue to struggle to dig out of the hole that occurred in the depths of that crisis. And, you know, by all measures, again, I just repeat the point I made earlier, Tom, if you look at employment cycles, productivity cycles, real income cycles, not over the last four quarters, as Alan's selective recall would want you to do, but over the broad stretch of this recovery, I challenge you to find a recovery that's weaker than this one. And
what's wrong with four quarters? Four quarters is a full year. If you're doing well over four quarters, doesn't that tell you something about where we are right now?
It tells you where you are right now, Tom, but it loses perspective of where we've been, and you can't just wipe that out. You know, here's Philip saying he hasn't had a raise in 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you want to tell Philip, forget the first 4 years now, Philip. How's it been for the last four quarters? Hey, may I tell you, well, it's been a little bit better, but it doesn't make up for what I've been through over this five-year period. And those are real, genuine comparisons that I think you lose sight of.
But if household balance sheets, Stephen, are in better shape today, isn't that a real sign of improved circumstances? That means less debt?
I'm looking at the consumer balance sheet right now, Tom. I'm looking at the debt-to-income ratio for American consumers. You know, it's come down from a peak level of about 134% to about 110%. That's debt, household debt to income.
Oh.
Average, though, over the final three decades of the 20th century was 75%. So we're still well above average levels of debt to income ratios for consumers. So to say that, you know, we've healed the balance sheet is ludicrous.
Well, I mean, better is better, but that doesn't sound like like paradise. Not everybody's...
You've got to do better than that.
I want to get a call here from Dothan, Alabama. Johnny, you're on the air, Johnny.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for a live conversation. I had to pull over side of the road on this one.
All right. What do you see?
I would like to get Steve to drink a cup of coffee with me, because in 2009, my construction company, we struggled. Mm-hmm. The economy hit us bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have a waiting list. We can't build them fast enough.
Are you building houses, Johnny, or what are you building?
Houses, and I have a brother in the car business. His dealership a few years ago was slated to close. Now they have three other franchises that they just built, and they can't sell them fast enough. So I don't know what kind of coffee Steve is drinking.
Johnny and his brother are doing pretty well in Alabama, Steve. Can't put the houses up fast enough, selling the cars out the doors. Alan Sinai, what do you say to Johnny there?
Well, I say let's drink a glass of wine and a half full glass to that good business. I think we get fair comments from the callers who are feeling distress, and that is the bulk of the American people. The polls tell us that.
Yeah.
This has not been anything like any other recovery and expansion in our history. To Steve's point, that is correct. I'm talking about better momentum and a better future. There's no doubt this has been the weakest upturn, the strangest upturn we've ever had. The distress people feel is in part because the benefits of the gains from easy money have gone to higher income people in the housing and auto businesses. You just had a caller say that.
Yep.
And the jury's out as to whether it will spread all the way through to Americans. I think it eventually will. But what's so different about the world today is, and 50%, 45, 50% of revenues of American companies come from overseas.
Yep.
Japan has to do better. China has to do better. Europe has to do better. And in those parts of the world, they are aggressively easing monetary policy, and it hasn't happened yet. And so at this moment of time, we feel a lot of distress. That is correct. But there's a lot of good stuff going on in the economy as well, and a lot of people are benefiting.
One more caller, and I want to ask each of you about the candidates out there, what they're proposing. Charlotte in Amherst, New York. Charlotte, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I've been retired for about 7 years, and I want to remind people of the fact that both retirees and younger people who have savings have been absolutely decimated with the low interest rate environment.
You get nothing off your savings. That's a brutal truth.
I spent my lifetime earning, including in the banking industry, saving, and I have lost well over $100,000 in expected interest in the 5-8% range that one could always get on CDs and other good quality. You know, all this talk up in the air is just that. It's talk up in the air. In addition, as far as inflation is concerned, go to a grocery store regularly, and I realize that's not included in the official numbers. We always eliminate unpleasant information. But the rate of food inflation in the past 7 years has also been exceedingly high.
Charlotte, I appreciate your call. Our time is short. Catherine Mann, you were on the Fed board for a long time. Now there's this issue. Will we finally see interest rates tick up maybe by the end of this year? They've held off of that. They may hold off still. Those super low interest rates have really put it to retirees like Charlotte. You can hear the pain right there, Catherine.
So with regard to the monetary policy, you know, there are pros and cons of continuing on with the zero interest rates here in the United States. I think you just heard one of the cons is that people who expected to earn more on their pensions are not going to do that. We have to ask the question, if you raise interest rates, is that going to, you know, reduce the incentives for investment even more? My view is no. You could afford to raise interest rates 25 basis points, and it would have no impact on investment because fundamentally there's plenty of cash on the balance sheet.
Not much impact for Charlotte either, a quarter of a percent. But
well, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Hey, Stephen Roach, if we look down the presidential list, you know, what is it? Carson, Trump, Clinton, Sanders, kind of the top of each camp. Now, where do you see hope in proposals?
Well, this is, you know, it's been an unusual recovery. It's been a bizarre presidential campaign. So right now, the policy debate has not really crystallized, I think, yet on sort of meaningful proposals for the economy. But Tom, I just want to really underscore the point that your last caller, Charlotte, made to focus on saving. Mm-hmm. America as a nation is in a hole with respect to its overall domestic saving. And, you know, here's Charlotte, who's tried to save all her life for her golden years and is finding that she's in a hole that she estimated about $100,000 because of no returns. We've got to really focus on building up our long-term saving as the seed corn of future economic growth. We're not going to be able to invest in our people, our infrastructure, our manufacturing capacity, our competitiveness if we don't save and at zero interest rates. That will never happen. And so she's entirely right.
But companies have been loaded with cash, haven't they, Stephen? Corporations loaded.
Corporations are saving, but people are not. The government's running deficits, and that's squandering our economic future. We need a candidate who can focus on saving, and that's what America has been great at over a long period of time. But unfortunately, we've forgotten how to do it.
A lot of roads merging in the woods here. Where we come out, well, it's the usual answer. Nobody knows, but it's been fascinating to hear each of you help us look at it this hour. Stephen Roach at the Yale School of Management. Thanks for joining us today, Stephen.
Thank you, Tom.
Alan Sinai with Decision Economics. Thank you very much, Alan.
Thanks, Tom.
And Catherine Mann, Chief Economist at the OECD in Paris. Catherine, thank you very much for joining us from France today.
Delighted to be with you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.